The SparkFile podcast may contain profanity and other adult content.
Please use your discretion.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in my SparkFile. To be something that I want to make or how I want to be, I pump it in my SparkFile. I jump into my SparkFile. Let's open up the SparkFile.
Welcome to the SparkFile, where we believe that everyone is creative, but smart, creative people don't do it alone.
I'm Laura Camion.
And I'm Susan Blackwell. If you're joining us for the first time, welcome. But you may be asking yourself, what exactly is a SparkFile? Where do I get one? What do I file in it? These are such good questions, and we have got answers.
We do. A SparkFile is the place where you consistently collect all your inspirations and fascinations. And if you're like us and making stuff all the time, you know that sometimes the wellspring of inspiration can run a little dry. We're here to refill it.
Yes, we're on the lookout for fresh ideas, images, and inspiration that spark our creativity and pique our curiosity, things that inspire us to get up off of our asses and make things like this very podcast.
Or no big deal, just some of the greatest musicals of all time.
Or several deep, long-term artistic collaborations.
Or a creative career that smashes boundaries and sets records.
Or a model for how to balance being very talented, very successful, very effective, and extremely kind.
On today's Makersode, we're going to talk to someone who truly sparks us.
And that someone is Susan Stroman. Stro, welcome to
the SparkFile!
I am very happy to be here. That was a swell introduction. I owe you both $20. Thank you.
$40. We're $40 richer.
Oh, this is
great. Moments in. Stro, we're so happy that you're joining us today. And we want to start by asking you, where are you right now? And how are you right now for reals?
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, I am locked down on 57th Street here in New York City. And I have an office that I am in. I have an apartment upstairs and then a little office downstairs. So I am office and happy to have an office to escape to, I have to say, in the same building. So I'm very, very lucky. And I'm doing okay. You know, it has been a wild year of just pushing through and trying to be creative, you know, because it'll take more than a pandemic to stop the creative juices from flowing, you know.
Truly, yes.
So, I've been a Zoom queen, you know. I've been Zooming with many creative teams and trying to create, so when we get on the other side of this apocalypse, I'll have something to show or pitch or to continue developing, you know. So yes. I've been doing my best to keep going forward.
And you've really been getting some stuff done during this pandemic. You've been making a lot of musicals over there, haven't you?
Well, I've been trying. The one thing that, you know, I was supposed to direct a play up at Williamstown for the summer called Photograph 51 by Anna Ziegler, beautiful play. Of course, Williamstown closed down, but Audible Books picked it up. And so we recorded it for Audible Books, and they gave me 2 weeks with the actors and then 3 days
Brilliant.
Of recording. And it was spectacular. I mean, so, in a way, it was so lovely that Audible Books did that, because of course they don't have to do that. They've got Obama's book. They didn't have to do this play.
But they're really, my understanding is that Audible is really committed to, I think that the head of Audible loves theater, is my understanding, and they are really committed to producing more and more plays for people to listen to in their earbuds, which I think is fantastic.
It is fantastic, and they were so collaborative and wanted to get it right, and so supportive of all the actors. So in fact, we were able to keep working during the lockdown in a new way, but still it produced something for Audible. So that was a good story.
Just adapting.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the pivot. Mm-hmm. I know sometimes it can feel like a pale comparison, but people who have been able to pivot into some other version of the work, how was your experience directing actors over Zoom, I assume?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. Well, you know, what's interesting for the play, it was wonderful in the sense that I was face to face with these actors and had them very close to me. And, mm-hmm. and in fact, since we were so close together, we were able to have a great dialogue in a way that sometimes you don't get in a rehearsal room.
So interesting. So
in fact, I liked it a great deal because we seemed to go into greater depth about things. And I know it was quick. We only had 2 weeks, but just as far as character work goes, in fact, the Zoom was very good.
I'm feeling it. Wow. People really talk some trash about the technologies like Zoom. And I know that Zoom fatigue is a very real thing. But it's been our experience that we've had amazing, really connected, sometimes transformational experiences over Zoom. It's sort of, mm-hmm. it is what you make of it, I
yes.
think.
Now yeah. Don't say that about the musicals. They were much more difficult.
Yeah,
that's
to
true.
Do over Zoom.
That's
because
true.
Because there is a lag, you know, there is, yep. you know, it's difficult to pick up cues. It's difficult to sing. Everything about it is difficult.
Yes. Yes.
But,
yes.
You know, you just kind of embrace it in another way. And a lot of it, creating a musical on Zoom has to do with the actors themselves going away and recording themselves on their phones and then sending it back to us. And then we mm-hmm. End up making a little edited Zoom movie at the end, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's right.
It's, I know, but it, you know, but again, it is a developing process that allowed me to go forward rather than waiting until this
that's
is
right.
all over to go back to these musicals. So,
in
fact, although it was more difficult on Zoom than the play, it certainly has added to the help of the development for its future.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Stroh, we always begin with the Spark File price of admission on this on these episodes. So real quick, can you tell us a creative risk that you've taken recently? Any of the aforementioned things might actually qualify for this. But specifically, did any of them feel particularly risky and you thought, hey, well, this isn't perfection, but it's progress?
Well, not as risky as walking up 8th Avenue. That is
risky. Yeah, that's the risk.
That's the old after 6 o'clock during the pandemic. That's the risky one.
Yeah.
But I guess, you know, I feel like everything I do is a little risky. Everything I seem to do has a bit of controversy connected to it. So, mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, one piece is a Me Too, has a
Ooh.
Me Too theme.
Yes.
And Diane Warren's music, wonderful. And
wow.
And it's risky to make sure it's entertaining, yet thought-provoking, yet mm-hmm. informative, and in these contemporary times, making sure it feels really relevant as mm-hmm. as time goes by, you know?
Yeah.
I think that felt a little risky. You know, the other musical is a Candor Neb piece that is John Kander has written new music for, and it's going very well, and again, it's about New York, and so it's I feel like everything I do has a little risk added to
yeah.
it.
Yeah, is that like part of the draw? Do you think like that is like part of what attracts you to a particular piece?
Yes, absolutely, because you know you want something to be riveting to an audience.
Yes.
You want
uh-huh.
them to be. You know, listen, I'm very lucky that I've been able to tell many different kinds of stories in my career, to go from, you know, Crazy Few to Contact to The Producers to The Scottsboro Boys, the kind
yeah.
of, you know, the diversity in the storytelling is something I relish, to try something new for a different crowd. Cause in the end, how a piece affects an audience is important to me and actually fulfills me. you know, to stand in the back of an audience and see an audience respond to something I've created, or a particular number, a particular stage piece, you know, to see them put their arms around each other in crazy few, or to laugh uproariously at the producers, or to cry at contact, or to start a conversation, as in the Scottsboro Boys, you know. So
yeah.
It's that kind of different reactions from audiences, it just fills me up. I mean, I love it so much.
Have you ever felt like, truly, I have no idea how people are going to respond to this? Have you ever felt scared, shitless?
yes, all the time. Yeah, yes, all the time, you know, because whatever you create, you sort of immerse yourself in this bucket of talent of actors, and and you don't leave the rehearsal room, and it's all about collaborating with your team and your designers and your composers, your lyricists, your book writer, and then your actors, and you don't really come up for air until that first preview, and then. Then you think of the audience in a way. You're so making the art of it and the collaboration with artists that you never know what's going to happen ever.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think you're officially admitted to the Spark File, by the way.
Yes.
I should have mentioned that. for people who don't know you, how you identify creatively, like when people ask, what do? How do you answer that?
Well, I mean, I am a theater animal. I love the theater so much.
I love that on your business card.
Theater animal, you know, and I love it all, you know. I mean, I do crossover, you know. I do musicals, I do plays, I do ballets, I do operas, you know. So I do crossover, and I love crossing over. And actually, I love combining too, you know, asking people from Broadway to watch ballet, asking people from the ballet to watch Broadway, you know, to really do a cross fertilization of all these art forms is really thrilling for me. So I have done that too, you know, and I adore that because I love all those art forms so much.
But we're going to go with theater animal, I think.
I would expand it even further and just say creative animal. I think, you know, you also, though it may not be your primary preference, you also work in film. I feel like you have sort of this limitless creative capacity is what it seems like from the outside. I don't know how it feels from the inside, but you're so curious and you're so game to try a lot of different stuff. So I'd go with creative animal, but that's an outside perspective.
I like it.
I'll take it. I'll redo my credit cards there.
There you go. So Stro, I've asked you about this before, so please indulge me because I'm going to ask you about it again. But you've talked about how you've had this clarity since you were pretty young that you were going to be a director, choreographer, you were going to be a maker of theater, but you also had this awareness that you would first have to come to New York City and learn the lay of the land by being a performer. This is so fascinating to me. Could you please articulate how you came to that kind of clarity at such a young age? And how the fuck you knew to be that strategic?
Well, you know what? Because I know a lot of people become directors or become choreographers for other reasons. Either they don't want to perform anymore,
they've mastered a
know, or that's usually the route, or they've been an assistant to someone and then gone that route. But I have to say, you know, I was in a dancing studio since I was about 5 years old, and I grew up in a house filled with music. My father was an incredible pianist, and so there was always music in the house, and I was that little girl who would dance around the living room to her father playing the piano. So it was very much a part of me at that early age, creating dance for his music. And so I from a very young age, I would be in dancing school of tap, jazz, ballet, and then, you know, piano lessons, guitar lessons, you know, then doing community theater. I just loved it so much. But I think it's the passion for the music that was the initial, the initial piece that,
spark,
that
yeah.
put me on this track. And, you know, so when I, so I started to direct and choreograph in that. I'm originally from Delaware. Yes. Yeah, so me and Joe Biden. And
yes, congratulations.
Yes, thank you. We both love the Amtrak. And so we, you know, I started there doing choreographing and directing for community theaters and high school marching bands.
What age were you then?
Well, probably, you know, 16, 15, 16, 17.
Yes.
You know, all that, all during high school. And then in college, I graduated from the University of Delaware with a Bachelor's of Arts in English. And, but I, you know, still was choreographing, directing, and I wanted to come to New York and give it a try, but I knew I couldn't come to New York and just take over. I had to come as a song and dance gal and then sort of assess the situation and then take over, you know. But so I came here and auditioned for a show, and the first show I got, first audition I got a job at the Goodspeed Opera House. And it was definitely, I didn't even know quite what the word equity meant, you know. So I, all of a sudden I had a job and, you know, sold my car and moved to New York. And then I just started working as a performer. But, you know, I did the national tour of Chicago with Gwen and Cheetah and Jerry Orbach. And I was the Hunyak in that. And then I started doing, you know, a lot of industrial shows. They were a big deal here. And then I...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And then I slowly started to cross over to direct and choreograph industrial shows. And then different club acts and things like that. They were very popular when I was... At that time. And and then one day, you know, I was in a, I did a show called Whoopi on Broadway. Mm-hmm. And then one day I was in a show that lasted a week on Broadway. It was called Musical Chairs. And I was sitting outside with Scott Ellis, who was also in it. We were both lamenting on how we wanted to be on the other side of the table. And Scott had done The Rink with Keander Neb, and I had done Chicago. But we didn't know them that well, but we knew them. And we thought, what if we went and knocked on their door and said, hey, what if you allowed us to take one of your shows off Broadway? And, you know, and we were a little afraid to do it, but we did it. And lo and behold, they said yes. And so... We took one of their shows, Floor of the Red Menace, and went down to the Vineyard Theater and said, hey, we have this show. Can we do it? And Doug Abel surprisingly said yes.
Yes, Doug.
And so we worked on that show one summer. I think we made about $200 for the whole summer.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Scott Ellis and I never went back on stage again. You know, that
there
was it.
Wow.
Because it was it, you know, how Prince saw it, Liza Minnelli saw it, you know, we became good friends with Keander Neb. It sort of just was that thing where you take a chance. And I do tell young people this, that, you know, you should always ask the question, because the worst thing that can happen is someone just says no, and then you can go on. But like, you always have to say, what's the worst thing that can happen? And many times those people will say yes. And in my case, it changed my whole life.
I love the image of the two of you and Scott Ellis sitting there on whatever you were sitting on, the steps, the curb, the fire hydrant, whatever you were sitting on. I love that, the idea of knowing, and it sounds like you knew it well before that, but really knowing at that moment that you were ready to migrate to the other side of the table. Mm-hmm. And then cooking up a plan to do
taking
it, not
action.
Waiting for somebody else to create the opportunity for you, but creating the opportunity for yourself and going to Keander Neb, going to Doug Abel. I just think that's how you do it. That's how it you
is,
do it.
You know, because you cannot wait for the phone to ring because the phone will not ring. That's you have right. got to go out and stir it up yourself. If you feel that you are a creator, if that you feel really believe in some, that you can offer something to whatever art it is, whether it is dance or whether it is theater, you know, if you really believe in that, then you've got to. I've got to go out and grab it because it's not going to come and tap you on the shoulder.
It's not.
Listen to Susan Stroman. Listen action. To her.
It's true.
It's true.
Listen, you've had such an astonishing career. I think it would be impossible for us to discuss everything that you've done. So just to narrow the field a little bit, can you tell us one of the things that you've made that you're just extremely proud of?
Well, you know, I think Contact up at Lincoln Center, I'm very proud of that because that certainly was taking a chance. And and in fact, you know, it was one of, usually shows are based on a novel or a film script or a poem or something else, but this was based on a vision of a girl in a yellow dress. And and so the idea that a whole show would come out of that was amazing, you know.
It's pretty special.
And, you know, and I happened to be in a club one night about 1 a.m, as you are.
as you do.
Downtown. And, you know, in a club where every good New Yorker was wearing black, and in this sea of black stepped a girl in a yellow dress, and she would step forward when she wanted to dance with somebody and then retreat back when she was done with them. And I got mesmerized watching her, and I thought, well, this girl's going to change some man's life tonight.
Wow.
And about 2 weeks later, I got a call from Andre Bishop at Lincoln Center, who had seen Steel Pier, and he liked what he saw. And he said, if you, you know, come up and meet with me. And then when I went up there, he said, if you have an idea, we will help you develop it. And to hear that was like music, because
amazing.
Usually someone's handing you some old script of, you know, some revival. So the fact he said, and he didn't say what it was. He said, it didn't have to be a musical, it didn't have to be a play, it didn't have to be a dance piece, whatever you want to do, whatever you want to develop.
Wow.
And I said, you know, I think I do have an idea. And I went and called my good friend, John Wideman, who, you know, he wrote Assassins and Pacific Overtures, and we had done the show Big together and became very good friends. And we started to talk about what this might be. And we got sort of an outline and then went back to Andre and Bernie Gersten, and they loved the thought of just letting us play in their rehearsal room basement there. And they gave me about 18 dancers and the wonderful Boyd Gaines. And
my gosh.
And they left me alone for a good 4 or 5 weeks, and then came down and saw that short story, The Girl in the Yellow Dress, and they loved it so much that they said immediately they wanted to produce it, but they said, do you have any other short stories? And of course I'm filled with short stories in my head, so I said yes. So John and I went and came up with two other short stories, one called The Swing and the other one called Did You Move, and created a first act, and then let the second act be The Girl in the Yellow Dress, and then the whole thing became Contact, and it ran up there for 3 years, you know. So I think that I think people, you know, because it was about making contact and the importance of making contact, and dance equaled joy and life, and dance equaled life, really. And so I think the audience, there was an accessibility to it that the audience never knew that they even had, and then they saw it and they imagined themselves as many of these characters, which I think is important when you're working on any piece, the having some accessibility to your audience where they can imagine themselves as somebody up there is I think a good thing.
Oh, absolutely. I'm just, my head is spinning with all of the like the goodness that you just described, like the freedom that they allowed you, the collaborations. It sounded like you even had freedom in just choosing who you wanted to work with.
Well, yes. Well, that's very much, you know, there's Lincoln Center is a very rare place. You know, it's a wonderful place to work and a wonderful place to create and wonderful place to create new pieces. And there's not that many places like that that would be so supportive and just take a chance on you. You know, not knowing what you're going to create, but just take a chance. So I'll always be grateful to them.
Yeah. Incredible. Another thing in what you just said that I love is how you, again, this clarity that you have. I think sometimes when people think of a director, choreographer, they have a set idea in their mind about what that person does. But you are also a person whose head is filled with lots and lots of stories. You are not just an interpretive artist. You are an originating artist who, Susan, you are about as close to a writer as you can get without claiming to be a writer.
Yeah.
Well, I do, you know, this, besides my father being a great pianist, he also told big fish stories, you know. So I grew up with stories. And of course, I don't know, he's gone now, but I don't know if those stories are true or not still to this day. But, you know, I think all of us in the theater are storytellers. And that's probably why we've been drawn to the theater, because someone told us stories as a child. And, I do have a lot of short stories in my mind. And I think as a director and a choreographer, you are also an observer, you know, of life. So when I'm even out at a restaurant, I see that couple over there and I try to imagine what their story is, you know, and create a whole story about them just by their physical manners. And I think most directors are like that. They're very much observers of life.
Just so curious about like your creative process. Do you literally write them down, or do you just have them cataloged in your mind and you can reach for them when you have, you know, a need for them?
No, I don't write them down. No, I
Susan Stroman.
I do. They're just in my mind. Yeah. You know, all these stories and different characters are in my mind.
Yeah.
And I hope they can all come out someday, you know, but
you keep working at this pace. You're gonna have plenty of stories to share. You said something, you kind of referenced it a moment ago, but I've heard you say something before that really spoke to me, and something that I feel personally, and I think Laura does as well. At some point in your career, you made a decision that as a director choreographer, you were no longer going to work on revivals unless they were revivals of your work. Mm. You wanted to be engaged with making new work. Talk to us about that clarity that you have around that.
Well, you know, I do love a good revival, and I'm happy to sit in the audience of a good revival and enjoy a good revival. But I think I was quite lucky when I came to the city that I got to do three of the big classics. I got to do the big Oklahoma, which I started actually at the Royal National Theater with Trevor Nunn as the director, and then I got to do Showboat, that big production of Showboat that Hal Prince was the director of, and then I got to do my big revival of The Music Man, which was the first thing I directed on Broadway, and so I'm very grateful for those real three classics, that American classics that, you know, I feel like I'm on the shoulders of those classics to have learned from them, you know, learn about structure, you know, learn about character. And, you know, so I do think back on those pieces, and I did adore them while I was doing them. And I think what I wanted to do now was use my time to create something new and be a part of creating new theater. And I know because of finances, there are a lot more revivals seem to have happened in the last 20 years. And but I, you know, you want to hang in there and hope that producers will allow you to create new pieces rather than doing a revival. But, it takes so much to create a piece of theater. I mean, it's a miracle a musical gets up.
It is
that you want your energies to go to that. So, in essence, I admire revivals and I love to attend them, but I don't want to use my energy remounting them.
Mm-hmm. I think and with all due respect to people who direct existing material, there's something about, especially people who have a dance background, I think they are apt to have what I call a puzzle mind, which is their minds work very quickly and they can solve big puzzles. And it seems to me that you have a mind that's big enough that it wants to solve these big puzzles. And when you're doing existing material, those puzzles were solved when mm-hmm. they were created years ago.
Yes, I think they were, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, can't help loving that man's gonna work.
Exactly. So you don't get the thrill that you were just describing of standing in the back and saying, "Oh, first preview, fingers crossed. I hope the audience responds in a positive way." That is because it's probably going to work.
Now, in addition to that, I have to say, what I did learn from Trevor Nutt and from Hal Prince is that they approach these revivals as if they'd never been done before. I know Trevor, when I met with Trevor Nunn for the first time, when he said Oklahoma to me, I went, "Oklahoma?" and then he said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, okay." So, but he said he wanted to do it in a new way. He wanted it to be about fighting for territory and about the Old West and tap into mm-hmm. the real research mm. of the Old West. And in doing so, then that made my choreography be more fight oriented, make it be more about fighting for territory with mm. real pioneer women with steps that say, "Can you top this? I'm king of the hill," those kind of themes of people fighting. I was able to feel as if I was creating something anew that had not been done before, even though we were still singing "There's a Bright Golden Haze on the Meadow." It was still, you just wanted to feel like you were creating something new. And I had that with Trevor Nunn. And then I had that with Hal Prince. It was Hal's idea for me to do montages that would push the piece forward in years, and within those montages, adding history so both of those directors saw revivals as something anew,
fresh puzzles to solve.
Yes,
that's great.
I'm really curious. Something you said a moment ago about how just how miraculous it is that any new musicals get made and how challenging it can be to get things made. Do you have any insight or thoughts about, do you think anything will change after this pandemic when we start to, bring it all back to life again? Do you have any thoughts or even hopes about things that might change about that process when we're
I think I actually think a lot of things will change. For one thing, the question of diversity is a big important point now, and I know that the theater will change because of that and mm-hmm. because of what's happened over this last year, and I look forward to that, and I see big changes happening there. And also, I think, it's interesting because I think there'll be more important theater that happens after this. People mm-hmm. will want to do theater that somehow makes a difference or somehow makes people think. But as I'm saying that, I also think people are going to be entertained when they come back, almost like from the Great Depression. That's why people went to see Fred and Ginger movies. They wanted to escape. And so I actually think there'll be both. Uh-huh. There'll be theater that'll be escapism, and then there'll be very, very important theater. I think there'll be both. Yeah.
I think that's a pretty good think.
Yeah.
I think you might be onto something there.
Yeah. It makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good.
I crave it. So, I crave both of those things. You know, as an individual, yes. I'm like, I flip flop and vacillate between the two.
Of course you do. And then the best of all possible worlds, you get something important that's also entertaining. Then you're good to go. Then you're good to go.
That's golden. A good night in the theater. Stro, back in 2001 for your work on The Producers, I'm telling you what you already know, but let me tell you again, as if for the first time, you won your 4th and 5th Tony Awards for direction and choreography, becoming the first woman to win both awards in the same night. You are also the first woman to direct a full-length ballet for the New York City Ballet. Can you tell us a bit about being a woman in these significant, even historic leadership positions and how your experience of being a woman in charge has changed over time, because the times have changed?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when I started, it was very male dominated, I have to say. But you know what? I was so immersed in the art of creating and loving it. I almost didn't take time to think, well, I'm a woman here. They're not going to let me in.
I didn't think
that they wouldn't let me in because I was a woman. But I realized now that I was very fortunate to have that forward motion, because I, you know, it's really only been in the last 15 years that women have been allowed to direct and choreograph. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when I started, though, I did, put on a black hat and a jacket and make sure that someone thought that I could pull this off and that I wasn't thinking about anything else but this theater piece. Mm-hmm. Now, I wouldn't tell a woman to do that today. I would say you need to dress just the way you want. You can wear big lashes or not. You can do whatever you want. But when I started, since I was in this male-dominated world, I needed to almost dress down and be very focused on the art itself. And nothing could... let anybody think I was thinking about anything else but their piece that they wanted me to mount, you know. So it was different back then. But as far as me thinking I'm not going to pull this off because I was a woman, I never once had that thought ever.
Yeah.
And I thought that my creativity was equal to the man that would be up for the same job or whatever. I have to say I didn't dwell on it. I just kept going forward because I loved it so much. I had such a passion for it, a real passion for it. And I think my passion just pushed through any kind of prejudice against me being a woman.
I love that. I love, like, you didn't focus on it. It sounds like you helped other people also, like, remove the distractions and stay focused on the work, not our genders, but let's just get this work done. Let's focus on the art.
Yes,
wow.
Absolutely. And I have to say, you know, people like Andre Bishop, who would say to me, you know, give me their theater to create something, is very special. Or Michael David, who allowed me, from the Dodgers, that allowed me my first job directing on Broadway with that big revival of The Music Man. You know, they probably felt like, well, this will be the first woman I've allowed to direct something, you know, but they took the chance, you know, and it worked out well for them. But, you know, I mean, you need those people to take chances.
That's right.
You know,
we do.
You know? And I think that's today too, because just like women now are in the forefront in a lot of places, you know, this is what they're talking about diversity, is making sure that in other departments in the theater, we are making sure we are allowing a more diverse group of people to come in and do it and make it happen. So changes will be made.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Thankfully so. Listen, a few months ago, Susan and I were doing this very podcast, and we share sparks with each other of things that are inspiring us. And Susan did a spark all about resilience and all the specific factors that make a person resilient. And we were thinking about the fact that you've lived through some tough stuff, some loss and grief and disappointment and heartbreak and a pandemic. What do you think has kept you resilient?
Well, yes, I mean, I have indeed lived in highs and lows, extreme highs and lows, you know, going through the AIDS epidemic here, I lost my roommate and my dance partner. Mm. And that was devastating, you know, at a young age and not even understanding what's going on here. So that was a very difficult time in New York. And just losing one's parents as one does, as you get older, everybody goes through that, but there's that kind of, all of a sudden you feel like an orphan, you know?
Yes.
And then my wonderful husband, Mike Ockrent, who I adored and had the most, fantastic relationship with, not only creative, but unbelievably romantic. And we were equal in many ways. And it was just like, feel quite lucky that I found him. And then I lost him, sadly, to leukemia. It is these kind of highs and lows, but that, you know what, that feeds your art in a way, you know? I feel like, especially doing some plays now, I feel like because I have lived this life of highs and lows, I have so much to give and so much to offer, because I don't think there's been any emotion that I haven't been through or tapped on, or that I can offer myself to actors and offer myself to help people through. So I think this kind of... this life, living life in extremes, you know, and even in the business, you know, I have had these big hits and I've had these shows that haven't done as well. And you have those extremes too, you know, and even that is heartbreaking. You know, it's heartbreaking when someone doesn't love your show as you love your show. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so you do live your life that way in these highs and lows, but I think it does indeed feed your art. And because, you know, art has to have great depth and has to have great levels and intensity. And those of us who have lived through these things can offer up more, and apply ourselves to these stories. You know, in the end, again, we are storytellers. And we can, because of the way one lives one's life, you can put yourself into a lot of these characters.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
right. We have been talking about, on this very podcast, we've been talking about how if you have creativity, it's such a gift, because you can live through things and then you can make things out of the things you have lived through. And it is sort of like, it was described in a conversation we were having the other day as it is a societal loophole that artists get to feel their feelings in a way that artists and athletes, in a way that is more, permissible in society. So it's a beautiful thing to hear you describing sort of taking those life experiences and having something to do with them. In addition to letting them move through you and moving through them and feeling them, then pouring them into the work and, you know, whether that's having them be of service to an actor that you're directing, or they become one of those stories in your head that's going to become a great piece of theater.
Well, yes. And you know, for example, you know, when I lost Mike, it was devastating to me and the grief was unbelievable. Yeah. I could feel, if you squeezed my arm, it's almost like I could see green pus come out. Like you could just feel like the grief was right under my skin for a long time. And the thing is that I was saved from that with the theater. You know, I don't know how people lose someone they love so much and they work in a job they don't like.
Yes.
They're working in an office they don't like. How they go through loss, because the theater really saved me, you know, because the theater is life affirming. Dance is life affirming. And to be able to go through a difficult time and then to go to the theater for help and restoration, I feel very lucky. I feel very, very lucky.
It's beautiful.
That's just beautifully articulated. That's gorgeous.
Stro, you are widely regarded as being obviously very good at what you do and very kind. How have you managed to be so good at what you do and so successful and so effective while also not being a total dick? How?
How do you do it? How?
Do you have any tips or tricks?
Tips for not being a dick?
Well, you know what? The thing is, you really, as a director, as a choreographer, you really have to have a respect for everybody in the room. And you have to, showing people respect will help them do their best work and make them feel like they are very much a part of it. So respecting the actors, respecting your team, bring that into the room. Mm-hmm. And you'll find that kind of collaboration, people just, anybody who is a bitch will just, it'll drop off of them, you know, it is making sure people feel comfortable and listening is a big part of it. Listening mm-hmm. to ideas, mm-hmm. you know, and when you say kindness goes a long way, you know, yes. And you know, I think you do remember who is not kind, you know, you do remember them. And,
yes.
And so you can keep them from coming into your life again, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, because you don't ever want to stifle anybody's creativity, you know, and even for actors, you want them, you know, when I do a show, I usually plan the whole thing out. I work on pre-production. I have it all worked out, staging and choreography. But when I'm in front of those actors, I don't usually share that with them. I want them to feel creative. I want them to feel like they're very much a part of it. So it's almost like I just created a net for them to fall in. It's because in the end, I am inspired by actors. I am inspired by designers. I am inspired by other people in the room. So I've done my work and my research and then be inspired by them. And I think that's how you get the best end result.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you're incredibly well-researched. You're incredibly well-prepared. And then you bring that kindness in, which I think is in you. It seems like this is not a tactic. It seems like it is woven into the fiber of your being, but it does sound like it creates a space where people can be very brave and feel safe about that bravery and risk taking.
Well, yes, you want to work with brave people. You want to work with fearless people, and you want them to be able to fall on their face and get back up again and try something else, you know, mm-hmm. and not be afraid that someone's going to, you know, tell the New York Times about it or whatever. You want, you know, you want people to just feel free to be able to fly in a rehearsal room. And absolutely. The thing is, if I do a lot of research and know what I'm doing, if they're flying the wrong way, you know, I can help them come back the right way because nudge I can them. Back it up, you know, with that's what right. I thought
that's
about.
Right. Yeah. That's right. That's great. That's great.
Yeah. And you mentioned listening too. You know, they've done so many studies on really how deep down each person just wants to be seen and heard. And so, you know, working with people who hear you, even if you don't always get what you want, but you know that, you know, your voice has been heard and acknowledged, it can mean so much.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I think listening is a big part of what we do as directors and choreographers, you know, because I I could create this incredible dance step, and then the dancer could say to me, well, you know, if I could just do that to the left, it would be much better.
Yeah.
Even and better. I go, oh, okay. You know, of course, that's a huge domino effect. But yes.
Yes, it sure is.
You know, so we, you know, I change it for them. And because in the end, I you want it to make it look like they've made up the whole show in a way. You know?
Yeah.
You want to be so comfortable on them.
Yep, and have them feel that way too. Yeah, that's exciting.
That's a kindness too, in a way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great.
Hey, there's another topic that we're obsessed with on this podcast, and that topic is how we process creative failure or perceived failure. And we were wondering if you would be willing to talk about one of the biggest perceived failures or challenges that you faced and how you processed it.
Well, it's interesting, you know, because I know this makes sound crazy, because I don't think of, you know, if something is a financial failure, that does not mean it's an artistic failure.
Right. So
you know,
yeah.
And if I've done things that have been financially failures for a producer, and they've always been an artistic success for me,
mm-hmm.
that I have learned something from them and something about my art. So if I have a show that, say, the critics don't like or just won't sell tickets, that doesn't mean that I didn't do something in that show that has never been done before, or I didn't do something in that show that I learned and was able to now apply to my next show.
Uh-huh.
So I don't look at those things of
uh-huh.
failures.
Uh-huh.
And you know what's interesting? I had there was a show that one of the hardest things I've ever had to do was mount a show during 9/11. We were right in tech. Yeah. It was called Thou Shalt Not. And Harry Connick had done the music. And it was a story based on Therese Rackham, which had not one redeeming character in it. So, you know, nobody after 9/11 wanted to see anything with anybody that's killing anybody, you know.
That's
so,
right.
So the timing of that show, which happens a lot, the timing of shows of what's happening
matters.
In society matters a lot. And that was a perfect storm of a show that was opening at the really wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
And, but you know, and I remember calling Bernie Gersten and saying, I'm so sorry that the show lost so much money. And he said, we don't lose money. And I said, what? And he said, we don't lose money. We spend money on artists. That's what we do. And it made me cry, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, they think up at Lincoln Center that they spend money on artists. That's what they do. So in the same way, I don't think of a lot of those shows as failures. I think they think too, that they have spent money on an artist who's now going to go on and do something else, you know?
Yeah.
And I think you have to feel that way, you know? Mm-hmm. Now, in the end, it is heartbreaking. Every time a show closes, it's heartbreaking because you don't, a lot of times you don't know why it didn't sell tickets because, you know, and some shows have gotten great reviews and they don't sell tickets and you think, what the hell, you know? But, you know, some things you can't control. All you can do is control sort of the art of it and what you create. And then it's a lot of times it's in the hands of folks that you have no control over, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's not, you know, so in answer to your question, that you do feel, you know, I feel sad for the actors or the people involved that now don't have a job. But it's, you know, you just have to go on and go forward and know that you did learn something from that show, you know, and, you know, I know in something like Thou Shalt Not, I had 3 turntables on stage in this set that went all different ways. And I know, and I choreographed on that and I know that hadn't been done before. And so I was able to learn from that and do a piece of art like that and work with wonderful Harry Connick and, you know, so, you know, it's just, so you do still fill up with the art of it, no matter what happens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I love that. It reminds me of this conversation we had recently with Sutton Foster. And the question stumped her a little bit because I think she has intuitively as an adult, lived a life where the story doesn't end with the quote unquote failure. The story continues on, and it's informed by what you do with the learning after. And I think that's what you're describing too, is how does it, how does that then fold into the investment of you as this continually growing artist?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think sometimes artists come up against a wall with that, you know, but they have to look what they created, look at what they have created, and learn from it. You know, I think it's just as in visual arts, it's, you know, when someone is painting and all of a sudden they see it go some other way, and they've only learned how to go that other way because they first painted the picture this way, you know, and they needed to add to it. And so I think it's, rather than just saying, oh, that's a damn bad picture and ripping it up, you know, they learn from that piece and end up doing a great piece of art.
Yeah. Stroh, is there a creative thing that you know you need to do before you're done?
Oh, well, yes, many things. a creative thing. Well, you know, I just love what I do. I just want to do more of it. And I just want to work and create and with creative teams that I love. And so there's not in one particular, like, if you mean, do I want to do a story about, I don't know what, a piano that plays by itself or something. No, there's no thing like that.
But hey, that'd be a great story.
Yeah. But there's all, you know, but I do want to keep going forward, you know, and just creating stories for the theater.
Just making work you love with people that you love.
Yeah.
Yes. And there's nothing better.
That's nothing better. That's true.
Dreamy. Hey, you've been in the creativity business for quite some time. Can you give us some good creative advice?
Well, I think, well, that first, what we first spoke about is not being afraid to ask the question, for young people who want to, whatever their art is, to reach out to professionals, you know. I know that my particular union, the SDC, has something called an observership, and young people sign up, and then professional directors who work all the time, choreographers, will take on an observer and allow them to be in the room. And in the end, to be in that room is so... filled with the learning opportunities, you know. It's to the advice for people who want to create is to try to be in the room, you know. And there are ways to do it, you know. There are ways to do it. There are ways to connect with the theater or connect with the particular union you're interested in being a part of, you know. But to, again, not just to wait about, you That's need right. to reach out, you need to figure it out.
Yep. Make yourself
and
useful.
Ask the question.
Get yourself in there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ask the
Fantastic.
Question.
Here's a philosophical question that we're mildly obsessed with. Susan Stroman, you work really hard. What's it all for?
Yes. What's it all for?
What's it all for?
You know what? It's for love. It is for love.
Yay!
It is
to show it, you know?
Yes, it is for love. You know, I am filled with love, and I have a lot of love to give. And
oh my God!
You know, so it is in the end all about love and loving what you do and loving the people that you are with.
Susan Stroman, it's such a great answer to the question, and also it's so evident in your work. Your work is filled with love.
Yes.
You send these love letters to, I think you love the artists you work with. I think you love your actors. I think you love your teams and your crews. And then I think you love your audience, and you send them that message straight through the different kinds of work that you do.
Well, I that's very nice of you to say. I mean,
I think it's true. I think you've really struck on something here.
Well, again, it's you know, touching an audience means a lot to me, and in different ways, you know, whether it's, again, like we said, making them laugh or making them cry or making them feel or making them think, some way to make them think about it after they leave the theater. You know, it's that makes me very happy.
Love. And finally, Stro, what or who is sparking you these days?
You mean, well, what inspires me is I am like a museum rat. I go to a lot of museums.
Oh, so classy.
Yeah, so I love art. I go I go to all the museums. I go to you know, all sorts of art festivals, and yes, even when we first got on here, you heard my art installation making noises.
That's right.
We had to shut it off. You know, but I am inspired by art. You know, I have a show with Lynn Ahrens and Stephen Flaherty called Marie. It's based on Degas' Little Dancer at 14.
Yes, yes.
And it stars the wonderful Tyler Peck from the Prima Ballerina at New York City Ballet. And, you know, and we were out in Seattle about a year before the pandemic hit, and all with hopes to come in, and now we're sitting in a truck. There's a truck with a lot of tutus out there. But, you know, but that particular piece was inspired by that sculpture, wanting to know who that model was, who was that little girl. And and she was a real historical figure. There was a little written about her, but there was enough to write a musical. And
there you go. Yes.
So, you know, I worked with Lynn Ahrens and Stephen Flaherty, and we worked for a couple years there creating this piece. And it's wonderful. And one of the themes is, you know, when Degas created that sculpture, he got the worst reviews he ever got in his life, and which was a shock to him. And he was so upset, he took it right out of the exhibit and put it in a closet and didn't come back out till like 40 years later after he died.
Oh my God.
And when it came back out, it was hailed as one of the, you know, 10 greatest sculptures.
Timing.
So it is about art not recognized in its time.
Yeah.
And of course, we all live through that. We all live through that.
Yes.
So I am very attracted to that theme, and it's the theme about women too, about what their opportunities were at that time in Paris, and how this little girl wanted to dance, and it meant so much to her to dance, but inadvertently, you know, she became the most famous dancer in the world because of that sculpture.
Wow. I cannot wait until you can get those tutus out of that truck.
I want
to see this. I
know.
Me too.
But I'm excited about the piece. I think it's one of the most beautiful shows I've ever seen. And I really can't wait for that to happen. So, yeah, and art, you know, and even in Contact, there's the opening piece is based on a Fragonard painting called The Swing. And, you know, so
yes.
I did down at the Vineyard Theater about 2 years ago, did a piece called The Beast in the Jungle, and that revolves around a Matisse painting called The Dance. And so I do love art, and I am inspired by art, and I do bring art into a lot of the work that I do.
And like you said, you're introducing, like you're mixing the art forms and introducing one to the other. So as theater goers,
she's a creative animal. She's a creative animal.
Beast. Yes. I love it. Oh my God. Susan Stroman, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Well, I've loved it. You guys have been great interviewers. Oh, it's been fantastic.
Thank you so much. Wonderful. We're gonna send you those two $20 bills back to you in an envelope for that. So that's it. This episode of The Spark File was made on Muncie, Lenape, and Seminole land. We hope it put another bunch of sparks in your file. And listen to us. If there's a spark you'd like us to explore, or if you've taken a spark and fanned it into a creative flame and you'd like to share that, email us at thesparkfile@gmail.com or submit it through our website, thesparkfile.com.
We will even happily take your feedback, but you know the price of admission. First, you have to share a creative risk that you have taken recently.
And be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe, rate, 5-star review it. If you like this podcast, share it with people that you love. And if you didn't like it, I don't know, Stro, what do you say to your critics?
What do I say to my critics? Well, you know what? I don't say anything to them. I just go on about my day.
Yes.
I love it. We'll do the same. We're going to go on about our podcast. If yes. something tickles your fancy and gets your creative juices flowing, we're writing you a forever permission slip to make that thing that's been knocking at your door. It's your turn to take a spark and fan it into a flame.
You gotta take it
and make it.
Bye. Thank you, Susan Stroman.
Thank you, guys. Amazing. Thank you so much.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in my spark file. Could be something that I wanna make or how I wanna be. I pump it in my spark file. I jump into my spark file. Let's open up the spark file.